Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life.
We have very strong direct-to-consumer relationships and a very strong direct-to-consumer business. Mm-hmm. That really is probably 80% of what we do here. And being able to talk to my club members frequently about what they want, what they're looking for, how they're enjoying what we're doing, what we can do better, is incredibly valuable communication to have from a business standpoint, certainly, mm-hmm. but also just from the standpoint of, you know, being a passionate wine lover. I want people to have relationships with my wine that really means something for them, that is
it's okay, it's just a working winery.
Yes.
No worries,
that means something for them, both from the deliciousness component, which is really fundamental, and the fun component, which is fundamental, and then, you know, as I keep saying, this emotional connection, this, you know, me speaking to somebody through what we've made.
So we're going to work on the awareness part today, because I'm going to talk for a minute about, I guess, answering my own question, what would help. I've been a strong advocate from the inception, really, for myself, that people need to really get to know the brands on their own. I don't think any voice, however formidable, singular or multitude, a chorus, as we have here today, in the current iteration of communication industry, you cannot outsource this at the end of the day. You have a palate, own it. So there's no shortcut. You just have to show up and you have to taste. So we're going to talk about, and please disagree if I'm speaking out of turn, if that's agreeable, we're going to talk about why people should taste your wine. And I'm going to ask you to start at the very beginning. Being seventh generation, I mean, you know, this country is, you know, not that old.
Right.
And the fact that your family has been doing this craft for basically roughly half of the existence of us as United States, I think it's very unique and bears a lot of attention. So take me back to your ancestors. You know, why did they wind up doing this in the first place? And how did it stay in the family for so long? Because there's a lot of barriers in between.
Absolutely. There aren't many businesses that exist for more than a couple generations, let alone as long as my family's has. My great-great-great-grandfather, a guy named Pierre Pellier, mm-hmm. came to California the first time in 1852. His brother was already here, older brother. Mm-hmm. They were from, I believe, the Languedoc area originally as a family.
Okay.
And came through a little town called Saint-Hippolyte, which is not far from La Rochelle.
Okay.
Just sort of a little bit further inland from Bordeaux. And La Rochelle was a major port town in the 1850s, from centuries before that even. He came to visit his brother, mm-hmm. As is sort of typical of my family. The gold rush is 1848 in California,
That's
so
right.
we get there 4 years too late for that. But we found this, you know, my ancestors found that where they ended up in Santa Clara Valley, you could grow anything in Santa Clara. The soils were amazing. Mm. The number of canneries that were there in the 1940s, That's 50s, right. and 60s was That's dramatic. Right. It was called the Valley of Heart's Delight, and that was kind of this place that you could grow anything. So Pierre gets through the little sort of inland waterway through Alviso into San Jose, meets his brother. His brother wants to start a nursery in San Jose. So they were nurserymen in France. I think most French families were growing, you know, either growing their own vines and making wine from that, or buying, getting grapes from neighbors or whatever and making wine. That was just sort of what people did. So the family had a history of making wine for God knows how long prior to that. Pierre Pellier goes back to France and over the course of the next year or so is sourcing cuttings. Mm-hmm. So John Hager, in his book North American Pinot Noir, has written that Agustin Herasthi, Pierre Pellier, mm-hmm. and one other person whose name I can't remember, all could have been the first person to bring Pinot Noir to California.
Wow.
So my great-great-great-grandfather did bring Pinot Noir, whether he was the first or not, I don't know. He is the first to bring Mourvèdre to California. Mm-hmm. He did bring the French plum tree. It became the heart of dried prunes for California.
Oh, that whole
which is,
stone fruit, right. Santa Clara, you're responsible for that.
That's my family. So Sun Sweet Prune Company, you know, was there because my grandfather brought those first plum prune trees.
How cool is that?
In 1854, which is cool. So the family brings these cuttings to California. They're nurserymen. They're there to sell cuttings to other folks who have got vineyards in the area. The family has, he ends up with an 600 acres, 1,000 acres or so in the evergreen area of San Jose, which is sort of southeast part of San Jose. Up, you know, kind of where Mount Hamilton is, mm-hmm. sort of the foothills there. Mm-hmm. There's another guy who has a vineyard there as well named Pierre Mirasu. Mm-hmm. So Pierre Pellier's daughter marries Pierre Mirasu, mm-hmm. and so he's kind of the second generation of the family. My family ends up multiplying generation after generation in that area of San Jose. Mm-hmm. And because you can grow anything there, they grew, you know, high quality fruit. They made, especially my grandfather's generation, the fourth generation, the Mirasu business was really more about bulk wine making for other wineries like Palmasan Almaden Winery at the time that don't exist anymore, and planting vineyards for people. In the early 1960s, 1961 in fact, yeah. my grandfather and great uncle bought a piece of property called the Mission Ranch in Soledad and planted a vineyard there. Still exists, still called the Mission Ranch, not owned by the family. So they were the first, we were the first to plant in Monterey County.
Wow.
In 1961. Mission Ranch first, and then San Vicente Vineyard in 1966 on the other side of the freeway. Mm-hmm. The Wente family planted there shortly thereafter. And now there's obviously there's a lot of great people growing fruit in that area.
Indeed.
The Mission Ranch is in what's now called the Arroyo Seco Appellation, which really is almost the same soil type as the Santa Lucia Highlands, except it's on the valley floor. So the SLH Appellation is really one that is sort of delineated by elevation.
Exactly.
Not so much soil and that sort of thing. So once you get up to 200 feet above sea level, whatever it is, you're now in that appellation.
Yeah.
We could have been in that appellation. They didn't really start until the early 1980s, mm-hmm. But we chose to stay in Arroyo Seco, or to have that our vineyard kind of, the boundaries changed, so that was Arroyo Seco rather than Santa Lucia Highlands.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, again, crystal ball, I'd rather be in San Jose Islands than Arroyo Seco. we were also growing, as typical for California wine families,
mm-hmm.
everything. Okay. Everything in the same place. So you're in a cool area. Monterey, the Salinas Valley, and that part of the valley gets wind whipping through it from Monterey Bay every day. It's similar to Livermore in a way, but dramatically more so.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that we were planting vineyards, my father and mother in 1963 are down there kind of managing row crops that we're also planting. So we're planting potatoes for Lay's Potato Chip Company and sugar beets for Spreckles Sugar Company. And my father's job is to change pipes, the sprinklers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throughout the course of the day, you change the sprinklers, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Wind starts whipping through Salinas Valley, you know, in the early, early afternoon. So it's one of these places in the world that has the longest hang time, one of the longest hang times of any other growing area.
Mm-hmm.
Vines don't like wind. They shut down when it gets really windy. It's very foggy in that part of Monterey. Mm-hmm. And so it really isn't until like 11, 12 o'clock in the afternoon that the fog burns off. You start getting sun down in the vines. They mm-hmm. start shutting down around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So you only really have 3 or 4 hours of ripening every day. Mm-hmm. So it takes a long time to get stuff ripe in mm-hmm. that area.
Mm-hmm.
So he's tending these crops. And it's so windy that, you know, we're watering some guy's field a quarter mile down the road because the wind is just whipping all the sprinkler water everywhere. And it ends up being an incredibly hospitable place for Chardonnay mm-hmm. Pinot Noir. The exact opposite for Cabernet.
Hmm.
And because it was sort of the tradition in California at the time is that they planted Cabernet there too. And it ended up being a real problem for the family. The Mirasu was a pretty prominent brand in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of publicity about this bell pepper, this pyrazine problem with Cabernet from Monterey County. And the brand survived, but not without taking a huge hit from the press and then from the consumers about this unripe Cabernet issue. And there's a lot of family dynamics that go into all that kind of stuff. But my father ends up leaving the family partnership in the mid-80s. It's two generations, two brothers, grandfather, great-uncle. The great-uncle really is sort of the foremost voice in the family. Mm-hmm. And there's a backing of, you know, one generation by one guy and the other, or one side of the family by the father, and the other father's backing it, sort of his side of the family. Mm-hmm. And it got to be too big an issue for my father to I don't really want this kind of thing in my life. Mm-hmm. He was a VP of sales. He was he was on the road a lot, traveling, selling wine, mm-hmm. building the brand. He leaves Mirasu in 84, starts a brand called Yvon Tomas Winery, which Yvon Tomas Wines, really kind of in a négociant outfit at first, buying wine and then making wine from Livermore in 1988 that was really good, value-oriented kinds of wine, $6-$7 a bottle back in that time. In 1996, I had come back from, I have a master's in literature. I went to George Washington University as an undergrad and then NYU as a graduate student, and was going to teach college literature, write books. That was what I wanted to do. Got married, had a couple kids out there in living in New Jersey. Decided in the early 90s to come out so my parents had a chance to see the kids grow up a little bit, and then we're going to go back to the East Coast. Well, once you get to California from the East Coast, my wife, my late wife, was from New Jersey. And mm-hmm. once you get here to the Bay Area, you realize that there really isn't, why would you go someplace else? There's no reason. And I started doing a variety of other things, and then finally kind of made a place for myself at the winery. And in 1996, we started the Stephen Kent brand.
Okay.
Family still owned Mirasu, so couldn't use it on the label. So Stephen Kent's our first and middle name. Mm-hmm. I'm a junior. So it was the two of us, the two Stephen Kents, made one Cabernet from Livermore with really the stated goal, knowing the history, knowing the viticultural conditions, that we wanted to make a cab to compete with Napa Valley. That was mm-hmm. the goal. One single vineyard cab from a vineyard about a mile and a half from where we're sitting now. And the 1996 vintage was a terrific vintage. It was well received by the press and by the consumer. And we kept sort of moving outward. I traveled a lot at that time for the mm-hmm. for that, you know, 19, when we actually released the wine in 1999 until about 2000, and I don't know, 5 or 6, you know, was gone every other week trying to sell wine. Mm-hmm. And realized pretty early on that time was much better spent talking to people. That distribution exists even more so now than it did then, but even then it exists to promote and sell big brands.
Yep.
That there's a symbiotic relationship between really large wine companies and really large distribution net companies mm-hmm. that only gets bigger and only gets more difficult to enter the longer that kind of environment exists in the business. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it made zero sense to travel to New York or Florida or whatever to try to sell a few cases of wine when you could sell the same number of cases every day out of your cellar. And mm-hmm. to build those stronger relationships, those more, again, emotion-charged relationships with wine lovers, mm-hmm. local wine lovers at first, seemed not only smarter from a business standpoint, but just it resonated with me personally mm-hmm. in a way that selling out in the street doesn't mm-hmm. even to this day. And so we've grown, we've persisted, we've pulled, you know, it's been a Sisyphean task convincing people that this valley is worthy of wines that cost what we charge mm-hmm. and is capable of making world-class wines. But it's been valuable. It's been, I've said before, you know, I didn't want to be the 400th guy from Napa doing that thing. I wanted mm-hmm. to be the first person from Livermore to do something that was world class. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're making a level of quality that's in that ballpark, and I think our best wines are certainly down the road in front of us.
So 1996, the first vintage. How did you learn winemaking?
Watching, tasting, making mistakes, reading, tasting. Working with winemakers at Wente. So we have what's called an alternating proprietorship. So we have a bonded winery within another person's facility, another winery's facility.
Oh, okay.
So we rent space, basically. So mm-hmm. We have our own equipment, but we rent real estate and make our wines next door. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from the guys at Wente, us, the small lot winemakers, the large lot winemakers at Wente become great friends of mine, and we mm-hmm. would taste a lot together, talk a lot. You know, winemaking as a task is not particularly difficult. It's not rocket science. You know, mm-hmm. it is undergirded by science, and there are things that you can measure, and there are things you need to pay attention to. But just as, you know, crushing fruit and leaving it outside will result in wine at some point in time, making really good wine is a bit of a craft that requires experience and requires, again, sort of a vision about what it is that you're trying to accomplish, and doing something, I think, ultimately that's appropriate for the vineyards you're using, the varieties that you're using, the area that you're in, and that's taken a while to learn about oak, to learn about what extended maceration does for you, to learn about what heated ferments and pump overs will do for you compared to open top fermentation and hand punching. These mm-hmm. are all things that we've learned over 25 years that allow, I think, for a level of quality that we're and a clear vision from a wine standpoint, from a structural standpoint, that we, I think, have. Mm-hmm. The fact that we now make 30 wines a year gives us a lot of practice each vintage, so it's not mm-hmm. we're not making just one wine a year. So we don't get, you know, haven't had 25 chances. We've had hundreds and hundreds of chances to do the right thing, mm-hmm. and fortunately enough for the consumer, they don't taste our mistakes. There aren't many. There are some, but we've at least gotten that part right in terms of making sure that what the consumer drinks is good.
So you're still the winemaker of record, is that correct?
I am the winemaker of record. From my perspective, winemaking is about blending. Okay. It's about creating from my perspective, and given you know given the winemaking for Lineage Wine Company and Stephen Kent Winery, the protocols I've created and communicated to my team over time. Luckily enough for me, I've got some young people in the cellar who like to do punch downs and who like to clean bins and tanks out. Very difficult work. Mm-hmm. And it's a great way for people to learn about what it means, you know, cleaning stuff up. And my son and his assistant Beth will tell you, you know, 50% of their time spent cleaning things. You want to have clean equipment. You want to have clean tanks. You want
to. Music to my ears.
You want to have as few opportunities for bad bugs to get into mm-hmm. your stuff.
Absolutely.
But it's the way that I look at my job now. Fundamentally, is I need to be able to communicate to my team what I think great wine is. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to communicate it. I need to be able to do that through letting them buying great wine, mm-hmm. letting them taste it, talking extensively about these wines that we taste, and look at historically what our wines have done and are doing, and look where we could have made different decisions that would have been made for a better result. Talk to our club members and people that we sell wine to figure out what it is that the consumer wants that is within our ability to deliver and desire to deliver. But blending is really, I think, where the winemaker has an opportunity to shape ultimately what it is he or she wants. And mm-hmm. that's still fundamentally my job. And so this young crew will get there at some point. And with Ragbag Wineworks, our new brand, that will be my son's opportunity to get into that maybe a little bit sooner than he might have thought he would be able to. But Yes, so short answer is yes, I'm still the winemaker.
So, again, going back to the big move that you made from New Jersey, there you were with, you know, a planned career in education, which is vastly different. Collegial background, clearly went deep there and invested a lot of yourself. Mm-hmm. Young family to support. You come to California, yes, it's pretty, but I'm sure even back then it wasn't inexpensive.
True.
What's in your head at the time? Like, how did you make this move?
Well, I mean, you know, I had confidence that I would be able to find a job. So okay. we just kind of left. We packed up our Toyota, little Toyota Corolla and a U-Haul. Mm-hmm. And we had two kids. One was 14 months, my son Aiden, who's now 27 and making wine. Mm-hmm. And my oldest daughter, April, was I think about 4 at the time. Mm-hmm. And my wife was pregnant with our third child. So we left July 4th, I think, of 1992 and took us 8 days to get to California. And I figured that I would find a job, mm-hmm. whatever it happened to be. My family was here, so mm-hmm. I knew we weren't gonna starve.
Okay.
We ended up renting a double wide in San Jose. And I got a job managing street sweeping contracts for a company for the city of San Jose. So the company had gotten this contract, and it was my job then to manage the information flow from our company to the city, mm-hmm. to deal with the public in terms of complaints or whatever, to create routes for the drivers, all this, because I would drive the truck every now and again. It was really interesting. I had been, you know, I had worked at blood gas labs at DC. I was pre-med for a while in DC, so I had a lot of experience doing a lot of different things. And this was interesting work. And so I would go to small cities and try to sell our yeah. street sweeping business, and we did sweep for other cities as well. And it got to the point, I was there for about 3 years, I guess, pretty quickly, that it was not what I wanted to do. I've always loved working. That's never been an issue. And getting your hands dirty, we do this in the wine business, you know, every harvest, all the time. So that's not an issue either.
It wasn't stimulating.
Yeah.
For you.
What do you do? I mean, you know, everyone likes yeah. a clean street, but okay, beyond that, what does it, you know, what does it mean? And so my father and his partner at the time were had been making wines for the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. Mm-hmm. for the whole chain nationwide, and they were on the road a lot dealing with the hotel properties. And my dad said, you know, if you want to get in the business like you say you do, then you should handle California for us. Just go out on the street and sell.
Okay.
Which I did, and I had spent about a year prior to that just tasting and reading and really kind of thinking about what this change would mean. Mm-hmm. I'd had a very short period of between my undergrad studies and graduate school. I came back to California for a year and wrote sports for the Monterey Herald newspaper for the year and sold wine for Yvonne Tomas Winery.
Okay. So you Yvonne had a Tomas little stint.
So I had a little okay. stint and realized that you know that it there are some really neat elements to it, and there are some elements that are you know as difficult as any other job.
Yeah.
You know, having to be lugging you know bags of wine around and getting mm-hmm. people you know getting people from no to yes is not always the easiest thing, and yeah, it happens a lot in the wine business. So I started working in California. My father's partner left very soon after I started, so I kind of ended up just sort of doing the whole country. Mm-hmm. I think my father was very excited and very. Surprise that I wanted to get in the business. So he took that, I think, the first opportunity to kind of work his way mm-hmm. out of things. Mm-hmm. And so it really became my organization to run. And we have a tremendous team here at our hospitality center mm-hmm. that's been here since day one, some of them anyway. Mm-hmm. So I've got a great team who helps really kind of drive our direct-to-consumer business while I'm out in the street and in the winery doing what I do. Mm-hmm. And the production part really kind of came into play in the late 90s is when I really had an opportunity to kind of dig in and mm-hmm. and start fashioning wines in a way that I wanted to do it rather than the ways that, you know, I was seeing, you know, from fellow winemakers in the mm-hmm. in the plant. And that's evolved dramatically since then.
So Ivan Thomas was a value brand. Is that a correct characterization?
Correct.
And then the Ritz-Carlton wine that you sold, was it a more, was it a house brand that you were making for them?
Proprietary
blends. Basically
by
the glass.
Banquets
programs.
By the glass.
Okay,
that kind
so
of thing.
It wasn't in the category of upscale.
Correct.
So would it be fair to say that you're the first generation that went after the upscale market?
Yes.
Okay,
fair
so what drove that decision?
You know, my what drove the decision was, I think what still drives me is, you know, this desire to do something great. You know, there's a lot of value-oriented wine out there that's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
But why would you want to spend the one chance you have at something to do something mediocre or something that's only value-oriented, that can be done and is being done by hundreds of other people, thousands of other people.
Yeah,
I've always had, I've always had an ego. I've always wanted to be involved with something great.
I'm glad you're aware of it.
Thank you. I am very aware of it. But I think, you know, kind of what drives you, I think, is
no, but it's
desire.
A value
it is.
As well. This is a core value, is what I'm
Absolutely.
Hearing. Is that there was no precedent prior to you
Correct.
Of crafting wines of individuality, of character, you know.
Correct. Not in the family business anyway.
Right, exactly.
My father was never on the production side, but he loves that. I can remember as a kid, you know, he'd come in with, he'd have a bunch of different wines open from a party or whatever he'd had, and he was, you know, blending stuff in the kitchen. He's always been a very passionate wine person and a guy with a great palate.
Mm.
So he was always keenly interested in that, wanted to have that be part of what Mirasu
sure.
did back in the 70s and 80s, and the rest of the family decided that that was not what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
So that was, I think, spurred my father's leaving, ultimately. And I've always, you know, wanted to be associated with things that were really good, things that were... again, I get back to this idea of that are meaningfully emotional.
Yeah.
You know, that they create, that you drink that for a specific reason, and it resonates with you for intellectual reasons, for hedonistic reasons, for heart and soul reasons.
Yeah.
And those kinds of responses to something don't generally happen with run-of-the-mill things. It's usually something that's either really, really wonderfully weird or really, really wonderfully excellent, you know. So that certainly informs, you know, everything that we do with all of our brands. We're trying to make the best example that we do at every price point. Some of the wines are meant really to be just purely joyful, fun, delicious Albarino and rosés.
Mm-hmm.
Something like Lineage is meant to compete with the world's greatest wines, and that for me hopefully becomes the final legacy that I leave for my grandkids and great grandkids and the like, that, you know, Grandpa wanted to do something special and he succeeded to a certain extent. Now it's our job to continue that, move it forward.
So what I'm hearing you say is that you've kind of really elevated the family brand, if you will, and that comes from, clearly there's some inspiration. You must have been watching your father tinker in the kitchen and going, what is that, you know? And maybe that filed away, but also you're a very driven person. Like you just described yourself, you're ambitious, you're thoughtful. And the fact that you went after a craft that, yes, I've heard this opinion that it's not rocket science, but it still has a lot of intricacies to it. And I don't mean that you need to go to UC Davis. In fact, conventional wisdom has it that you probably should throw away 90%+ of what you learned in any collegial environment,
yeah,
because hands-on is invaluable. So you chose a path that's not that easy, and you could have chosen another wine country where you could have, you know, become a seller at, eventually consulting winemaker, and developed a name for yourself. I have no doubt, knowing you and how, you know, you really want to, you know, conquer not the world at large, but your world. You want to shape it in a manner that makes sense to you.
The conclusion of this interview can be found in the next podcast, already available for your download. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson.